Thank you for downloading The Life Scientific from BBC Radio 4.
My guest today is breast cancer pioneer Valerie Burrell. A brilliant mathematician, she was Australia's junior chess champion as a teenager. She shone in her own studies as well, getting a first-class degree in medicine. But unhappy with the uncertainties of diagnosis and decision-making as a doctor, she turned her back on clinical work in the quest for answers to the bigger questions about public health. The causes of cancer, effects of the contraceptive pill and of the radiation from Hiroshima and Chernobyl, and more recently as lead investigator on the Million Women study, looking at the risks and health effects of hormone replacement therapies, HRT. She's been described as an amazing icon of epidemiology and is currently director of the Cancer Epidemiology Unit at Oxford. Professor Valerie Burrell, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Valerie, are you more motivated by the desire to improve public health or by your passion for the use of maths to work out the causes of disease?
I think I'm motivated to answer questions that women want to know, and it's women in particular, I think, that women want to know about what they can do to improve their health. Probably 90% of what I do is actually getting data, getting it clean, putting things into order so that I can look at the final result. But that's definitely my personal pleasure. But I do it because for the health of women and for public in general.
And how rewarding is this sort of work? I mean, do you often encounter resistance when ultimately, you know, you're telling people what's good or bad for their health?
Yes. I think I'll give two examples. The adverse effects of hormone replacement therapy, which people who advocated their use were very upset about, and so that offended people. But curiously, I've also done quite a lot of work on the effects of radiation in workers in the nuclear industry. And actually, we found that there really, if you followed all the people who'd worked at Harwell, Aldermaston, all these nuclear establishments in the UK, that there was really no discernible increase in cancer in the population, in the people who'd had the heaviest exposure to radiation. And that annoys people because a lot of people believe that radiation's really bad for you and it must be terrible. We must have made some mistake. So on both sides, you can find no effect of something and people get upset. You can find a harmful effect of something and people get upset. So it seems to me in this, because the work I do tends to be of importance to the public, there's always someone who's upset by what we find.
And I want to come back to your work, but I want to first find out a bit about who you are, Valerie Burrell. Now, Anne Johnson is Professor of Infectious Disease at University College London and on the Board of Governors at the Wellcome Institute. You were her mentor in the early 80s, and you've been a friend and a colleague ever since.
Valerie is very special. She's warm. She's very encouraging to women. She's very determined. I think she's very brave in some of the things that she's done in her work. She's very focused on where she's going and what she wants to do. Part of Valerie's focus is not to get distracted by things. And typically, Valerie, I think, was probably almost certainly the last person to have email. And now, even when you write to her now, you write to her PA and not to her directly. She's extremely principled in the best possible way. And she's got epidemiological green fingers. When Valerie's got a really good problem, you know, she's like a dog with a really good bone. She just has to keep at it until she's absolutely got all the best out of it.
Right, Valerie, what's this about you being one of the last people to get email?
Well, I also was one of the last people to get a desktop computer. I found that if I had all the data in front of me and I could analyse it, I would never do anything else because I'd find it so I couldn't stop, as Anne implied. I would keep on looking at the data, and actually that's not my job. I've got other people who can do that. Once I have something I want to know the answer to, and I don't stop. But that's a failing, I would say. It's also a strength, but it's a bit of a failing as well.
Now, your parents went from Austria to Australia in the 1930s because World War II was imminent, and you were born just after the war. Did your parents have high aspirations for you?
No, quite the opposite. I didn't do very well at school initially, and I think it's true that my mother at one point said she'd be quite happy if I became a hairdresser. So, no, they didn't. I didn't shine.
Yeah, but she
when
may
I
have just said that because she wanted you to be
so
happy.
No. I think I didn't shine that much when I was very young. As soon as hard maths started appearing later in schooling, I had an aptitude for that. But no, I would say I didn't have many talents when I was sort of up to about age 10 or so.
You were always good at maths, though. What was it like being junior female chess champion of Australia?
Well, I have to say this was in the late 50s, early 60s, and not many women played chess. So I have to say I didn't have too much competition. But I think it was the first time I got into something. And to play chess well, you have to play chess all the time, think about it all the time, do it all the time. I used to have a chessboard on my lap at school, and so it gave me something to focus on.
But I guess it's possibly your skills at maths, which were truly recognised when you went to university. Yeah. Your tutors would actually come to you and ask you, as an undergraduate, to basically do their homework for them.
Yeah, I was naive then, and I didn't really think about what it said about about the medical stuff. But to me, it was just doing something that was simple and fun. I was a young girl. I was more interested in partying and doing other things. It didn't occur to me that this was in any way unusual or special, no.
But you did actually get a first-class degree in medicine, and you say you didn't work as hard as maybe you should have done.
No, I didn't. I actually did all the kind of postgraduate training as well. I got my membership of the Royal College of Physicians. I did all the things that one was supposed to do. And then I had no more exams to do, no more hoops to go through, nothing else. And I thought, oh, you know, I've got to be a doctor now. You know, it didn't quite occur to me then. And my first year after I graduated, I worked in a hospital in Sydney. And one of the ways out at the time was to go on this happy trail across Asia and to work, ultimately to work in the UK. That seemed to be a line that a lot of people took. And so I decided, and usually after my first year, to the point where the head of medicine at the time, who was very, very influential, who was one of my big supporters, he said to me, if you leave, I'll make sure you can never get a job again in Australia. So it was extremely unusual to leave so early, and particularly because I did have promise of being, I could have been a high flyer, I guess
so
people thought that.
It was a huge step for you to take, to give that, leave that all behind.
It did not for one moment occur to me that it was. I just knew I was going to do it and I didn't want to stay. The idea of a career has never been what's driven me. It's just what I've felt was the right thing to do at a certain time. And then I was very fortunate. I worked for Charles Fletcher at the Hammersmith Hospital, who was one of the pioneers of a lot of the public health of anti-smoking activities. And he directed me to the School of Hygiene to do epidemiology. I hardly knew the word epidemiology existed.
And your interest in the contraceptive pill in particular, was there something that...
Yeah, well, I started working in a family planning clinic because I was a bit bored. I was still wondering a bit what I was going to do. And that was in 1970 I started doing that, the Brook Advisory Clinics. At that time, they were set up because GPs wouldn't give young unmarried girls the pill. And they used to come in, and one after the other, they'd ask, what are the effects of the pill? And I said, don't know. And, you know, you don't get pregnant, but don't know about the rest. So, and then I knew I was going to study women, and I was going to focus on women. And so I knew that there needed to be some more answers.
Now, this might sound like a naive question, but you know, as I understand it, you know, the definition of epidemiology is that it's the science of looking at populations and then making conclusions about the cause and spread of disease. Is that a fair answer?
Yes, it's really the study of an association between some sort of exposure and some disease. And by studying large populations, you can find an association between, let's say, taking hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer. And it's not that difficult to demonstrate an association. But then the question is this causal or not? And that's the difficulty. One can bring in lots of mechanisms, but there are all sorts of checks in the way you analyse data. Like if it is, taking HRT causes breast cancer, you have to look, well, is there the time relationship? Does the time relationship work? is there a duration effect? If you take it for longer, does it have a greater effect? If you take it away, does the risk go down? Does it make sense biologically? There are a whole string of reasons that you have to go through and try and convince yourself and others that really this isn't just an artifact. It's the artifacts, the spurious associations you're really worried about.
One of the most famous examples of this is Richard Doll's work in the early 50s on the link between smoking and lung cancer. Yes. I mean, it is remarkable when you think back at the work he did or the time when he carried out his research, because back then it was 80% of men smoked back then, including Richard Doll himself.
Right.
And deaths from lung cancer, of course, were very, very high. Yet when his results came out, the Department of Health at the time didn't want him to say anything because his results might scare people. It does seem extraordinary now, doesn't it?
Well, it did. It took 20 years before the government and the public started to take this seriously. But Richard was very focused, more focused, I think, than I am, and he knew that he'd have to assemble more information. That's why he started the British Doctors Study, where he got doctors to fill out questionnaires about their smoking habits, and that led to even more evidence. And he just persisted, and he had, I think, a very difficult time over a long 20 years.
The science of epidemiology, you know, we talked about, you know, association, but there has to be sort of causation as well. But surely when you find a link between some drug or lifestyle, say, and cancer, isn't then the real science about understanding why that link exists?
It's part of it, but in public health, you don't need to know why. I'm not so interested in why. I think other people can look at that. To me, it's what do you do about it? And again, going back to smoking, that was one of the criticisms for a long time. Until we understand how smoking causes lung cancer, we can't really believe it. But they've never understood it.
So you think, you know, so, not needing to know the mechanism is a way of just getting something done quickly.
Just getting something done quickly, yes.
But it must bug you that you don't know. I mean, it would me, not knowing the reason why something causes something.
No, you have an idea. You know, there are things that cause cancer in animals. Smoke has got all sorts of things in it. Hormone replacement therapy, I mean, they're hormones after all, and we know that hormones are the main factors in breast cancer, so it's sort of self-evident that has some role, and it's not illogical, it's not like absolutely extreme, and we're very careful if we find something that doesn't make sense, and doesn't make sense in any possible mechanistic way, we're very, very cautious that that might be something spurious. But the precise nature of how, that's for other people, have to do focus.
Well, yeah, you mentioned you moved on and worked in other areas. I mean, you've been described, or the list of things you've worked on has been described as an epidemiological cause celeb. You've studied Hiroshima survivors, Chernobyl, HIV and AIDS, estrogen in pregnancy, but you returned to studying the effects of the contraceptive pill. Yeah. Why were you drawn back to that?
Well, when I first went to Oxford, if you read the papers at the time, the biggest front page news story was about the pill causing breast cancer. Some studies were showing it did, seemed to, some were saying it didn't. There were very violent disagreements at meetings about what studies meant. And it was really clear that you needed to get the data together. So people agreed to try and put all the data together and have it based in Oxford with me and Richard Doll and Richard Peto. And that really started me in a different direction, really was great, as it turned out.
And you've now been described as a breast cancer pioneer, and you've said it's a myth that we don't know why breast cancer is so common, that in fact we do know.
Yes. Now, this is very important. It was as a result of the work that you've just described, where we brought all the studies of breast cancer, all of the data together from all around the world. And when you look at these, apart from the effects, looking at the pill, which is how we started, but if you look at other factors in breast cancer, the big, big causes of breast cancer worldwide, really important. People have known for hundreds of years, I'm going to say, but it got lost, is that if you have few children and breastfeed for a short time, as happens in the West, the rates of breast cancer are very high. Or turned around, if you're in a developing country, you have 6-7 children, you breastfeed each one for 2 years. In places like that, breast cancer rates are very low. In the West, where the patterns are different, they're very high. And when you look numerically at how much each year of breastfeeding has an effect, it explains 2/3, if not more, of the difference in breast cancer risks between developing countries. It's to do with childbearing patterns. In the West, women don't spend their life either having children or breastfeeding. If they did, they'd have very low rates of breast cancer.
But we can't suggest that women should have lots of children in their 20s in order to prevent breast cancer.
But what we know, and we know that these effects are persistent, we know if you have one birth at, say, 20, you will have a 10% reduction in breast cancer risk for the rest of your life. If you have two births, you'll have a 20% reduction, et cetera, et cetera. So it means that something that happens in those 9 months gives you a lifelong protection of, say, 10% for each time. Now, surely, if we knew exactly which hormones, it must be something to do with the hormones of pregnancy, we must be able to work out which hormones and then give people a few bouts, like, and I call it a vaccine, but I don't mean infection, but it's like a hormonal vaccine for a few months when women are in their late teens and 20s, and we could prevent 10, 20, 30% of breast cancer in the West. It's a crime. It's absolutely terrible that no one is trying to look at this seriously.
It clearly angers you that this isn't widely acknowledged, or that maybe not enough research is being done.
You know, this has all been published. I'm not saying anything that isn't published, and published by, from the worldwide evidence, but it's not popular. And people don't want to believe it.
I mean, so you're saying, we could have, you call it a vaccine, but, we could have something that would prevent a large fraction of breast cancer.
Yes.
Is there any suggestion that, then why not? Is it, drug companies don't find this profitable? Or?
No, it's because of the ethos of cancer research now, medical research. First of all, grants are given for three-year research. They want results in 3 years, 5 years. And this isn't a three-year, five-year project. This is a 10-year, 20-year project to really get it sorted out. And it's just not the way medical research is going at the moment. And so I hope, I'll say this, I often say, I hope that the big breakthroughs in female, a lot of big breakthroughs, the development of the pill was done outside the standard medical research community. It was a wealthy woman who was interested in birth control who funded a group outside a university to develop the pill. IVF was not establishment, was never funded by this, was regarded as not anything that would ever be funded by the medical establishment. Outsiders funded it. And my guess is that some wealthy person, I hope one day, will fund an institute to just do that, and they'll get the answer. And as I say, the person who does it will get a Nobel Prize. They won't publish every year in Nature or Science, but they'll get a Nobel Prize. One can hope.
Well, it was as head of the Cancer Epidemiology Unit that you started one of the biggest, most ambitious investigations into women's health, the Million Women Study. Recruited, in the end, more than a million women over the age of 50. Your predominant interest was in the possible health effects of hormone replacement therapy, HRT. You published your results in 2003 about the risk of breast cancer associated with HRT. 5 years later, the risks were still being debated. Tony Mander from the British Menopause Society was invited to discuss them with you on Women's Hour in May 2008.
What we're trying to say is to look at the data that's occurred in the last 5 years when there were terrible scares, a bit like the Salmonella scare, and a million women came off HRT in the UK. There are risks attached to some types of HRT with breast cancer, but these risks are less than the risk of breast cancer if you smoke, or if you're overweight, or if you drink a lot of alcohol. There are risks. They're much slighter than some of the other lifestyle risks attached to breast cancer. We really do need to look at what we're going to do for women in their 70s and 80s to keep them fit and healthy.
Come on, how would you respond to that?
I've just thought the only way I can answer that now is to say he reminds me of Karl Rove, who, when the election was on, the last American election, and apparently on Fox News, Karl Rove was still disputing it when Obama went on television, was announced the winner of the election, and he was still trying to argue some complicated reason about why the figures were wrong. And it doesn't jibe with the government's advice. The government has clearly said that women should take HRT for as short a time as possible, based not only on my findings, but findings from the Women's Health Initiative trial. It's a minority view that this man has expressed. It's against the government advice. And what can one say?
Well, OK, let's start with what did you find about the risks of HRT associated with breast cancer?
Well, we found, and others too, other randomised trials as well, found there was an increased risk of breast cancer. And it was not a small increase, particularly with one type of HRT, which about half the users used. We found a substantial risk of breast cancer. We estimated that there were probably about 20,000 extra breast cancers over the last decade because of use of HRT. And the evidence has not changed till to this day. If you took women who were not on HRT, women of the age 50s, early 60s, which is when most women took HRT, if they weren't on HRT, 20 would develop breast cancer in every 1,000 over the next 10 years, which is a big number. It's 2%. Breast cancer is unfortunately very common. If they took one type of HRT, estrogens and progestogens, it went from 20 to 40. So there was the increase doubled. So instead of 2% getting breast cancer, 4% would. With estrogen only, which is another type of HRT, it went from 20 to 25, so it wasn't such a big increase. So it was a big increase in breast cancer. It was something that women needed to know about. It was their business if they took HRT or not. That's not my call. But they needed to know that these were the risks. And if they were worried about breast cancer, it was something they had to bear in mind. My interest is in getting the information out there, not necessarily what they do. But it's very distressing when the evidence is there, when the regulatory bodies all over the world have said these sorts of numbers make sense, to have others say and tell women this is not true. I don't mind them saying this is the risk, it's okay. But they cannot tell women it's not true.
But you did receive criticism about the findings and the methodology. Some said that because you'd recruited women from the NHS breast screening programme, it wasn't a representative sample of all women. Some of them would have had a higher risk of breast cancer anyway, presumably they'd been recommended by their GPs, or that, you know, they'd been advised to have a scan. Yeah. So it wasn't a fair sample.
First of all, the screening programme invites women. You can't self-refer and the doctor can't refer you. The breast screening program invites women every 3 years and they just have a rota. They go around and it's just every woman in a certain age group gets invited. So it's not true. But even if you bear that in mind, if you take out the women who had a breast screening, who had a cancer diagnosis, you could argue that they went along because they were worried they're on HRT and went along. But if you even take them out of the analysis, in fact, the risks are even a bit higher. So we've answered all these questions. We've answered them repeatedly. They're not true.
The other one I've heard, and again, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, people have said that the study was flawed because cancer tumours that might already be there are harder to detect with a mammogram in women who are on HRT.
Actually, that is right. But because they're harder to detect, it actually goes against the argument, because if you took those first mammograms out, in the subsequent time, the risks were even bigger. So they're absolutely illogical, but it doesn't stop people making criticisms.
How did you personally respond to this criticism? How angry did it make you?
I don't know if angry is exasperated, disappointed, I think, are the words I would say. But I'm disappointed, I think, also a little bit, I would say, with the press, who likes this as a story and keeps repeating it when it's really just not true anymore, and it's not, and just the same old hackneyed, tired stories keep coming out, and it makes women doubtful. But if you look at the statistics, first of all, none of the regulatory bodies have ever changed their advice since 2002, saying if you want to take HRT, take it for as short a time as possible, slow dose as possible. That's never changed. And the doctors, GPs who prescribe, know that that's still the case. And use of HRT has halved in the last 10 years and is still continuing to fall. So the good sense is that people are not listening. It's just causing media concern, but not real concern where it matters.
And that reduction of a half, this is, you know, a million women stopped taking HRT. Mm. You must have been pleased by that public response.
Yes, that million women stopping has meant that there are 10,000 women in the last decade who would have got breast cancer who haven't as a result. And that's good too.
Going back to the initial reaction to Richard Doll's finding on the link between smoking and lung cancer, you know, the Department of Health back then didn't want to scare people. This stuff is very emotive. Do you think, you know, as the person in this case, doing the scaring, as it were, that people would be angry with you personally.
Well, they are. Yes, they are, and that's unfortunate.
You are now a fellow of the Royal Society. You were made a dame in 2010. Are there enough women at the top of science?
Absolutely not, and that is a disappointment to me that women aren't there. And I think a lot of women, in particular, I'll say, don't want to take the flak that I've had to take. You have to really go through it and just tolerate unpleasantnesses. You do have to stick up for yourself and take the knocks a bit. And I think a lot of women who are very capable, who are very good, but just don't want to put themselves in that position. I think that's because they do say, and I think there is a bit of truth in it, that when it comes to very senior positions and so forth, women don't apply. Women are very good up to a certain age, and then when it really gets to senior positions, a lot of women back out of them, and they mustn't, I feel. They mustn't, and and I would support anyone who feels like that. Anyone who ever asks me, I definitely say, go for it, I'll support you. It's not easy, but you've got to do it, you've got to do it.
Do you feel a responsibility as, being a role model for other women in science?
Yes, I think so. I do. I think particularly in the field I'm in, I think a lot of the problems are people's egos and setting themselves up with certain positions and so forth. And I think women are better at being sensible and seeing reality as it is and not using their research to further their own careers. And I think these arguments about HRT would be less if there were more women involved in this field of research.
Do you think the structures in science that support women work in the right way? Are they in place?
They're in place and they do work. And most people I speak to do want to have more women in science, do want to have more women in senior positions. And I want women to feel they can do it. And I didn't have confidence either, and I've said that. And I think that you do need support to take the step. And, it's easy to feel isolated and as if you couldn't quite cope. And so I feel women need to be supported and have their hand held through difficult times.
Valerie Borrell, thank you very much
indeed.
Thank
you.
We hope you enjoyed this programme from the Life Scientific. There are hundreds more science programmes in the Radio 4 Science Archive. Find these in the Science Explorer at bbc.co.uk/radio4.